From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. In 1959, Alfred Hitchcock was looking for something new. By then, he was an acclaimed director with films like Rear Window and Vertigo under his belt, and he could do pretty much whatever he wanted, and what he wanted was to do something different. A friend called him relentless about not getting into a rut. And then he came across a novel, which appealed to his abnormal sense of psychology, a man who commits murder while dressed as his dead mother. The book, called Psycho, was considered too repulsive to be made into a movie, but Hitchcock was determined. The writer Stephen Rebello says Psycho appealed to his savage sense of irony. Rebello's book on the making of Psycho has been turned into the film Hitchcock, and it's now out in theaters. And he's joining us today to talk about the creation of what is still considered one of the creepiest, scariest movies of all time. Join us after the news. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. The writer Stephen Rebello says the filmmaker Alfred Hitchcock was always on guard against repeating himself. Some people think of Hitchcock as a horror director, but Rebello says that's way off the mark. Hitchcock was never committed to just one genre. In Rebello's book, he tells the story of how Alfred Hitchcock came upon a novel called Psycho right around the time he was looking for something different. It was in 1959, and the book featured transvestism, incest, necrophilia. Rebello says Hitchcock knew the idea of a man dressing up like his dead mother to commit murder would be difficult to transform into a film, but he was looking to make a break with his movie-making past. Rebello's book on the making of Psycho was the basis of the film Hitchcock, which is now in theaters, and today in the program he's joining us to talk about it. We invite you to join the conversation. 801-585-WEST is the number, 801-585-9378. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Stephen Rebello is a screenwriter, a journalist, and an author. He's a contributing editor to Playboy. He's the author of the book we're talking about, Alfred Hitchcock and the Making of Psycho. And we should mention the film is playing now in Salt Lake City and around the country. And Stephen Rebello is joining us today from Los Angeles. Stephen Rebello, welcome. Thanks very much for being with us.
It's great to be with you.
Well, I guess we should start with the first. Do you remember the first time you saw the film Psycho?
I do. I was a very young boy living in Fall River, Massachusetts. A city notable mostly, I think, by my most people's standards, because of the crimes of Lizzie Borden, yeah, an axe murderer. So I suppose it's rather appropriate that right. I saw Psycho in Fall River, and I can very strongly recall the impact that it had upon me, but I can even more strongly sort of recall the people around me. Because it was a small city, yeah, and a very grand theater in which the movie played. But I knew most of the people. We all knew each other. And, you know, for a little boy to see school teachers and gas station men and restaurant owners really beside themselves, you know, kind of running up the aisles, covering their mouths, yeah, you know, screaming uncontrollably. You know, and admitting, you know, I can really, what I want to share with you, is, and it's hard, is the involuntary sounds coming out of men and women.
I mean, they were truly distressed and truly stunned and shocked by what they saw and experienced. So it was, it almost had the feeling of you know, an audience at a Greek tragedy. I mean, yeah, like emotions were being ripped out of these people, and they were expressing them involuntarily.
At what point did you realize that this film was? I mean, you were fairly young when you first saw it, so I'm not sure you, yeah, recognized at the time. This is new. This is different. But at what point, or maybe you did? But at what point did you realize that this was, in terms of the culture and the time, and we're talking about 1960, but it was just on the sort of the cusp of, you know, that 50s Eisenhower era coming to an end. At what,
right,
point did you realize that was it, that this was some kind of important marker?
Well, these things take time to settle in, and this movie was so unexpected for so many people. I was a kid who wrote and was very imaginative and liked horror movies. And what I knew was that this was not like the others.
Yeah.
that this was something very different. And I didn't understand a great deal of it because, you know, they were grown-ups talking, and sometimes they were half naked. So, you know, that all seemed, you know, very exciting, but it also seemed, you know, strange and kind of brave new worldy. But I mean, even the ads for the movie were unusual. I mean, you didn't see American actresses, you know, in a half slip and bra.
Yep.
In those days. So, you know, it was quite unique. But I mean, in terms of, you know, zeitgeist and culture, that took time to, you know, to kind of to, you know, to for people to really absorb the shock of the new, because it was so extraordinary. It was so ahead of the curve. And it did anticipate so many things that were about to happen in the culture. And certainly were about to happen in film culture as well. But you know, we have to remember that the movie itself, Psycho, had you know, terrible reviews, and people said awful, I mean, truly awful things about it.
Yeah.
That it was an embarrassment to Hitchcock's career, and people were stunned that he would, you know, quote unquote, lower himself and demean his reputation by doing something that wasn't Cary Grant and Grace Kelly, and wasn't Technicolor, and wasn't, you know, wasn't elevated and sophisticated and beautiful people in exotic places. And those were the very things that he was running from willy-nilly. I mean, he wanted to really make a clean breast of that, at least, you know, at least for one movie. He basically wanted to beat horror meisters at their own game by, you know, I mean, his question to his, or his comment to his wife and to his staff, were, you know, they were talking about how horror movies were making so much money at drive-ins and at theaters. And he said, you know, his whole intellectual puzzle and his game was, but what if somebody good actually made one of those movies? And, you know, and enter Alfred Hitchcock. And you know, what if we got really good people to star in it? And what if we had a really good screenplay? And, you know, and that's what happened. But, you know, to say that the culture was ready for it, certainly not.
Yeah.
Audiences were ready for it somehow. I mean, you know, audiences flocked to see this movie right away.
You know, I think one of the really important points about that I hadn't realized was how important, in fact, relentless is how a friend put it, how relentless it Alfred Hitchcock was about doing something different, about not being settled in one form or one style. And that's why I mentioned that in the introduction, that he's not just of one kind of form, but he really didn't want, I guess he didn't want to be complacent about his art. Is that how to put it?
It's a great way to put it. And look, this gentleman was 59 years old when Psycho, the novel, came into his life. And all around him, people, other directors, you know, from the United States and all around the world, were doing Hitchcocks. That is, they were doing thrillers that were, you know, in the style of his British thrillers, his American thrillers. They were copying him. And I feel like in many ways the walls were closing in on Hitchcock, and he felt that you know, here people were imitating him. Studio executives and audiences were feeling that they basically knew what the Hitchcock brand was. You know, they knew what to expect, and he wanted to defy those expectations. He wanted to, in a sense, we would call it now, reinvent himself and shake up the brand again. Even if it was for just one film, it didn't turn out that way, you know. But he had a real horror of repeating himself. But yet, when he tried to not repeat himself, whether the film was kind of the quasi-documentary, The Wrong Man, or the kind of the pastoral comedy, the Trouble with Harry, or the metaphysical love story, as he called it, Vertigo, audiences stayed away. They didn't want any part of it. They didn't. Those were not financially successful films, and in some cases, they weren't critically successful films. You know, initially. So, I think that Hitchcock, you know, because of age, because of his artistic temperament, because of his, you know, because of his position within the movie industry, saw the handwriting on the wall and realized he needed to reinvent himself or be crushed.
Well, let's. let's talk about, as you do in your book, sort of begin with that true story that becomes the inspiration for Psycho and others, we should mention, but a story that plays out in Plainfield, Wisconsin, and the revelation of the crimes of Edward Gein. Talk about that story, because that's the thing that really gets us started.
Well, Ed Gein was, I guess you would call him, this is an awfully politically incorrect term, but I mean, I think most people in the town in which he lived just thought him an oddball,
yeah,
and kind of a simpleton, in that he was quite quiet and he lived on this rattletrap ruined farm, really.
Yeah.
His brother had died some years ago. His mother was an invalid, and he babysat for kids. He hunted. He spouted peculiar theories about Christine Jorgensen and sex change and not Nazi atrocities. And I think people thought he was quite peculiar, but he was not so peculiar that they didn't trust him to babysit their children, which I think is always kind of an interesting thing. But he seemed harmless. And the novelist, Robert Bloch, very wonderful and forward-thinking novelist named Robert Bloch.
Yeah.
His genre was really suspense, but suspense with a tinge of horror. He had studied with Lovecraft and H.P. Lovecraft, and he really knew his stuff. And he took Gein as kind of an inspiration rather than as the model.
Right.
The Norman Bates character of Robert Bloch's book is an older man, an alcoholic, a drinker, bespectacled, kind of gray and pudgy. But he manages a motel and he has a mother and all of these things, which none of which Ed Gein had. So I think really what Mr. Bloch took from the real facts, which were horrific and certainly not fit for us to be talking about it at 10 o'clock in the morning or at 10 o'clock at night for that matter. We're truly the stuff of nightmares.
Yeah. But wait, I want to read a section though, because I think it's okay for us to say something about this, even though it wasn't the direct, I mean, it's the thing that got Robert Bloch, and I want to spend some time with him because I think he's crucial to the story, of course, as well.
Sure.
But here's how you put Ed Gein's sort of sum it up, I guess, in some ways in your book. You say, deep in the night, while his hardworking neighbors made love, snored, studied the good book, fretted over bills, bland, simple Ed Gein delved into the mystery of how things worked by traipsing around the farm with the skin, hair, and face mask of newly exhumed corpses strapped to his naked body. So it gives you enough to know this is what was going on with Robert Bloch. And Robert Bloch, I think when you think of Psycho, most of us sort of think of Alfred Hitchcock, but the man who created the story, who drew the inspiration from those terrible crimes of Ed Gein, and all of those iconic story elements, Norman Bates and that twisted relationship with his mother and that creepy voice of Mother Bates and the fact, as you say, that he was a motel keeper, all of that was Robert Bloch. And it made me wonder if you think Robert Bloch has received enough of the credit for this story.
No, of course he hasn't. I mean, the story of the young secretary feeling that she's at the end of her rope and her lover, and she steals $40,000, and the sister and her lover who goes searching for her, the detective. All of those things are laid out in the Robert Bloch book.
Yeah.
All of them.
Yeah.
So he certainly hasn't gotten his credit, the credit he deserves. He knew that. He felt that. When Hitchcock bought the book, it was Hitchcock's want to obviously get the lowest price possible. And so he would do blind bids. That is, he would have his agents talk with writer's agents, and they would never mention Hitchcock's name,
right,
because of fear of driving the price up. And so, basically Robert Bloch received a very measly, when it came right down to it, about $5,000 for the rights to a book that, has spawned a number of sequels,
yeah,
a number of about to spawn another television series.
Yeah.
Lord help us. But the thing is that Robert Bloch, felt embittered by that. Writers didn't fare well in the Hitchcock universe, and that no matter how talented the writer and certainly the screenwriter of Psycho, who adapted Robert Bloch's book, Joseph Stefano, was also a very, very gifted guy. But in the Hitchcock universe, the name Hitchcock, you know, really took precedence over everything. You know, I've been talking about the film Hitchcock and my book, Alfred Hitchcock and the Making of Psycho, because, you know, the book is coming out again all around the world.
Right.
And someone recently on a radio station, someone, you know, very, very bright, said, well, you know, Hitchcock wrote everything that he directed. And I said, really, tell me more, because, you know, I hadn't heard that before. And this person was really shocked to learn that, you know, they were novels and they were short stories and they were screenwriters. And this gentleman felt that Hitchcock's reputation had, I had diminished Hitchcock by telling the truth that, no, it didn't all spring from Hitchcock. You know, Robert Bloch wasn't even invited to the set. He happened to be on the set of Universal where the film was being shot, and he wandered onto the soundstage one day. But really, and he did get to see one of the first cuts of the film. But, you know, that he was really sort of kicked to the curb, and it's really unfortunate because he laid down the template for all of it. You know, while Hitchcock and his screenwriter elevated the material in certain ways and deepened and enriched it, it all came from the very strange and brilliant and devious and twisted and kind of heartbreaking and very humane mind of Robert Bloch.
Yeah. Stephen Rebello. His book is Alfred Hitchcock and the Making of Psycho. It's just in paperback. You can still get the book, of course. It has a preface that he's written in it as well. And it's also the basis, of course, for the movie Hitchcock, starring Anthony Hopkins and Helen Mirren. And it is playing in theaters around the country. It's at the Broadway Center Cinemas in downtown Salt Lake City until, I think, Thursday. We're going to take a brief break. Back in a moment. This is Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today on the program, we're talking about the classic film Psycho. Stephen Rebello is our guest. His book is called Alfred Hitchcock and the Making of Psycho. It's also the basis, of course, for the movie Hitchcock. Talking about how it required others for this to have happened, we need to mention some of the women in Alfred Hitchcock's life, because you write there were three particular women in his life that you write about who were sort of strangely in tune with him. We'll get to some of the others, his wife, of course, among them, Alma. But let's talk about Peggy Robertson, who was a production assistant of his, a longtime partner of his. She's the one that sort of weeds through all this stuff and brings, as I understand it anyway, brings this book, this idea to Alfred Hitchcock.
Well, you know, Peggy was an extraordinary woman. Thank you so much for bringing her up. Toni Collette plays her in the film, but there's far too little of her for my liking. But in any case, you know, Peggy Robertson, it's hard to even give her a title because she was so many things.
Right.
But let's describe her as a person, a very British, very proper, highly intelligent, very intuitive, a very strong sense of what an audience likes, a very, very strong sense of what Mr. Hitchcock would toss out of hand. You know, one of her many jobs was to help him comb through material. It was very, very difficult through all of his career, but particularly in the late 50s and into the 60s and beyond, for Hitchcock to find, you know, the kind of material that really excited him, that is a bit like something he'd done before, but yet quite unique. And he drove everyone, in, you know, just crazy. His agents, his, you know, literary people, he had kind of beating the bushes to find good material. But Anthony Boucher, who was, in his own right, an extraordinary writer, had a weekly column for the New York Times then called Criminals at Large. Mm-hmm. And every week he would review books that he thought in the criminal mystery horror genre that he thought were either awfully good or awfully fun to shred apart.
Yeah.
And so he really made special note of this Robert Bloch novel, Psycho. And Hitchcock read that column every week, and so did Peggy Robertson. And the two of them, you know, on a Monday morning, sort of came in with this, you know, this review from Tony Boucher's column circled. And my sense in terms of Peggy Robertson, who really was elevated from basically a secretary for Mr. Hitchcock to, you know, almost a production assistant, really. My sense is that Peggy almost circled it in a sense like throwing up her hand saying, okay, we cannot find anything for you. Perhaps this daft, unfilmable, you know, penny dreadful, as she called it, horror novel might appeal to something in you, Sir Alfred, this morning. And I think she was stunned when he said, this is it. This is exactly what I'm looking for. A way to beat the horror directors, you know, the William Castles and the studios at the time, like American International, Universal did some. All of them were kind of trying to get that drive-in theater teenage audience in more than once. But Hitchcock thought, there was something about that review because Anthony Boucher really liked the novel, and he was a very, very smart man. So they, you know, they grabbed a copy of the novel. Hitchcock read it, and he knew this is what he wanted to do. And everyone around him sort of thought. I mean, literally everyone around him, Peggy, Alma, you know, all of the women around him, all the men around him, frankly, thought that he would take, because he often did. That central kernel of an idea, you know, a young woman, young but beginning to age, afraid of becoming that dreadful old word that we used to use, a spinster, you know, wanting to get married, tired of making ends meet, steals $40,000, and something terrible ensues. And everyone around him thought that he would blow it up and that it would become, suddenly it would become a Grace Kelly movie.
Yeah.
Or that it would become, you know, but then she'd go to the Riviera and have, you know, incredible adventures. But no, Hitchcock was dead on. I mean, this is the novel he wanted to film. Yeah. He wanted to find a way to film it, to beat the censors, to, you know, to give it the Hitchcock touch and yet to go into new, dark, unexplored for him areas. And so, Peggy really was flummoxed by this decision. And in fact, I'll jump ahead just for a second.
Yeah.
Peggy was so smart and so intuitive and so aware of how Hitchcock's associates were stunned by this that when she was on the set, she would go around to the very dispirited, and I mean this, very dispirited crew members who were working on this or Hitchcock associates who would drop by, and to each of them she would say a variation of this, don't worry, he's got his next one all set, and it's completely different from this.
Yeah.
And they would all walk away relieved. Oh, good, the old man hasn't lost his marbles.
Wait, which is to say what? That don't worry, he's got to get this out of his system. We'll move on to the regular Hitchcock later.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Stay tuned.
Yeah.
The Hitchcock that you know and love will return after this brief and inexplicable detour.
Wow.
So Peggy, because, you know, Hitchcock actually lost some of his top associates. They refused to work on this movie. So Peggy was a buffer. She was a sounding board. She was highly opinionated and, you know, like Hitchcock like his wife Alma, she did not suffer fools.
Yeah. You say in the book that this the novel appealed to his savage sense of irony. That's how you put it. And it made me wonder, is that how the film is supposed to be seen in some ways with a tongue in cheek, with a kind of sense of irony? Because I think I'm not sure that's how most people experience it, at least not at first. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it makes perfect sense, and it was a discussion that I had with Anthony Perkins for a really long time, and let me tell you why. Hitchcock told himself that it was the irony that appealed to him. That is, terrible things happen to really nice people.
Right.
People make crucial decisions, irreversibly bad decisions, when they think they're doing something that will help them change their lives, and instead, that decision ends their lives. There was something, almost Dickensian about the society that Hitchcock thought Psycho was depicting, that poor people, that middle-class people, that lesser-educated people get ground down,
right.
that life can be really terrible to really decent, basically decent people who happen to make poor decisions. And so there was all that sense in him of, well, this is the movie that we're making. And because because some of the material is really highly gothic. You've got a spooky house on the hill. You've got a raving mad thing, running loose. It's the stuff of Bronte. It's the stuff of far lesser writers than Bronte as well. It really, in the wrong hands, could have been just ridiculous. And Hitchcock embraced the ridiculousness of it, and yet saw the humanity of it.
Yeah.
And in terms of the absurdity that he found, he loved the idea of playing with all those elements. Like, okay, let's make it really raining, and let's make that house truly spooky and forbidding, and let's in the house really make it gothic. And let's do lots of mirrors and shadows and all of those things. So, his tongue was planted fairly firmly in cheek. Now, the dispute that I had with Anthony Perkins is that his contention was that Hitchcock directed his actors to play it straight.
Yeah.
There'd be no winking.
There'd be no telegraphing
to the audience that we're having a good time here. We're pulling your leg. And his reaction, that is Mr. Perkins' reaction, was always that when Hitchcock first experienced the film in theaters with audiences, he didn't anticipate the laughter, and the laughter was ringing and huge, and Alma, Hitchcock's wife, consoled him, as did other people around him and Peggy as well, by saying, "You don't realize that they need to laugh. It's the escape valve. This couldn't happen to them, or this couldn't be real, or it's the laughter after you built the tension in such a masterful way." And they weren't lying. They weren't trying to placate him, but Hitchcock himself had a hard time with understanding how that fine line between they're laughing with me and they're laughing at me. And Anthony Perkins, who had just a brilliant sense of irony in the macabre, and just a wonderful, wonderful, funny, intelligent man, he got it right from the beginning. He got that, if they stepped, they put one little pinky over the line, that the whole the whole house of cards could collapse. But for Tony Perkins himself, He loved the character of Norman. He identified really strongly, and Hitchcock loved him. He loved his intelligence. He loved how deeply Anthony Perkins felt this role, and how he identified with a difficult mother. What it's like to be a good-looking young guy who is dealing with a mother who has very, very strong opinions and can be, in a sense, castrating. So, Hitchcock loved Janet Leigh. He loved Anthony Perkins. He loved people he felt were giving 100% to the role and had really invested in their roles. But that issue of irony is a good one. I'm glad you brought that up.
There was another thing that you mentioned before we get to the actual shooting of the film. You say with Psycho that Alfred Hitchcock was finally laying claim to something that he had craved since the mid 1950s, and it was this It was like he was looking for a kind of credibility, or he had the, it was a score, you say, he had to settle with H.G. Clouseau, the French film director. That was an important motivator for him at this point in his life. Would you talk about that?
It was a very important, it was a score that he had to settle in that, this didn't happen overnight, this need to find something different, this need to, to go into new territories. And Hitchcock had found the novel, Les Diaboliques, the Boileau-Nurse-Jacques novel, and he lost out on the film rights really by less than 10 minutes, I think. And it really bothered him because the wonderful French director Clouseau, H.G. Clouseau, made such a good film of it. It was in black and white. It had this kind of, grimy people trying to make do with less than they needed. People with either motives that were highly complex, dangerous, dark, or inscrutable, people who were inscrutable, who didn't show themselves. And Hitchcock had really felt that was, if he'd gotten to do that, it would have shown his new colors, which would be lack of color, black and white, and more kind of in the noir kind of genre that Hitchcock really liked. And on the rebound, he bought another of their novels and turned it into Vertigo, but he didn't do it in that style. He did Vertigo, of course, in a very hyper-romantic, surreal, extraordinarily beautiful and hypnotic style. But with Psycho, finding Psycho, he really felt that he could go Clouseau one or two or 40 steps better in that he could, for example, with Diabolique, you couldn't enter the theater. You couldn't enter the theater because, once the film had started, because, the ending would be tipped off.
Yeah.
But that was, as I understand it from people who saw it in the era, that is Diabolique, that was more a gimmick than anything else. With Psycho, Hitchcock decided that he was going to make it part of the selling of the movie and actually put it in the contracts of the theater owners who were going to show the film, that audience, you could lose your license. They could take the film away from you if you let audiences in once the film had started. But, Hitchcock at that in the 50s, in the mid-50s, had begun to be idolized by the French, who many of the critics who became big in the new wave of filmmakers, the Chabrols of the world, the Godard, the Truffauts, they kind of took Hitchcock under their wing in terms of they felt that Americans weren't really understanding what a profoundly gifted and talented and deep artist Hitchcock was, and I really think that Hitchcock wanted to give them a French influenced movie that would play into the very things that they were telling him he was so very good at, but somehow American critics were missing. I mean, Academy of Motion Pictures Arts and Sciences was never kind to Hitchcock. American critics were not particularly kind to Hitchcock's films. They dismissed him as a very proficient light entertainer, and many of them thought his early British films were superior, and that the movies that he was making during the 50s, Rear Window and The Man Who Knew Too Much, Vertigo, were big, bloated, technicolor kinds of overstuffed Valentines, like big, fluffy, tufted pillows. And so they looked at those films with disdain, and that really bothered Hitchcock. He truly craved respect from the Academy, and he certainly wasn't getting a lot of love from them. Mm. And so he did want to go into something darker and more profound. Other directors around him were doing it. Certainly Otto Preminger was doing it, and Kazan was doing it. And we had this kind of kitchen sink melodrama with the Paddy Chayefsky stuff, the Marty kinds of things that were happening, and he just felt audiences were ready for it, and he felt they were ready for it from him, and he wanted critics to take notice that I'm not the Hitchcock I'm not just the Hitchcock you think I am.
Stephen Rebello is with us. His book is Alfred Hitchcock and the Making of Psycho. It's also the basis, of course, for the movie Hitchcock, starring Anthony Hopkins and Helen Mirren, and it's at the Broadway Center Cinemas in downtown Salt Lake City until Thursday. We'll take another break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today on the program, we're talking about the classic film Psycho. The writer and a scholar Stephen Rebello is our guest. He's written a book that explores Alfred Hitchcock's making of the film. The book, of course, the basis of the film Hitchcock, which is now out in theaters. Stephen Rebello's book is called Alfred Hitchcock and the Making of Psycho. And he's joining us from a studio in Los Angeles. Stephen Rebello, let's talk about, I guess, first of all, the actual shooting of the film itself. And it raises the question of what it was like to work with Alfred Hitchcock, because you talk about how some people said, you know, he was you write about the fact that he was ready when shooting began. He wanted the script perfect. He had it all laid out. But then others have said that he wasn't your let's get down to work kind of guy, at least not initially in the earlier. He wanted to conceptualize. He liked to take his time. So what was it like working for him when shooting actually started?
Well, Psycho was shot very quickly and very inexpensively, but he wasn't the kind of director who did a lot of takes, and he didn't spend a lot of time with actors in terms of motivation, and some actors perceived that as he's indifferent toward me. More intelligent actors would realize that he trusts me, and so for example, Janet Leigh. When she, basically talked with Hitchcock about doing Psycho, he told her that, look, everything has been laid out for you. Costumes have been chosen. Camera moves have been chosen. Sets have been chosen. Paintings on walls have been chosen. I need you to move from X spot to Y spot. I need you not to ask why, but I also need you to know that between you're moving to X and Y, that's for my camera. But in that space, you create that woman. Anything that you want to do is Marion Crane. The same thing with Anthony Perkins. So working with him, I guess it depends on whether he liked you or not. Liking you, in my experience of meeting Hitchcock and talking with Hitchcock, a lot of it had to do with something as simple as just the way you looked and dressed. Yeah. I mean, that sounds pretty superficial, but that was part of it. But another part of it was that he liked people with a ready laugh. He liked people. he would judge someone by quick and dead, as quick or dead, by whether they got his jokes, whether they understood his dark sense of humor, his funny sense of humor. Janet Leigh, for example, said that while they were shooting Psycho, she had a tendency, beautifully prepared actor, by the way, she wrote a complete history of her character, from birth to school, to what was in her closet, to what she read, and she presented that to Hitchcock, and he was enormously impressed because he found someone else who cared.
Yeah.
It mattered to her that she was going to be good, and so he loved that. But she had a tendency, as she told me, to get nervous. She had a stammer, pretty bad one at times, and she could get over serious just in the effort to please a director as lofty and as brilliant as Hitchcock. And when he would spot that in her, he would call her aside, have her sit, you know, in the director chair, in a chair next to her and him, and he would tell her the filthiest joke he could possibly dredge up from his imagination. Now, for someone like Janet Leigh, she would laugh uproariously and then go do her scene. A more relaxed, confident, easy person, which is exactly what he was trying to do. Henry Fonda told me the same thing. That's what he would do. Now, some actors, you know, depending on the gender, might find that offensive. Other actors might find that, imagine I'm going to do my big dramatic scene and here he is cracking jokes. Now, someone like Anthony Perkins understood what he was up to and loved it.
Yeah.
So those are the kinds of things he would do. I mean, he would say to people, look, it's only a movie. And I know that that cliche gets spouted about again and again and again. But what he was trying to say to people is, let's have some fun, you know, because if we're having fun with a script this good, with a director this good, with a technical crew around you, it's going to work out okay. Mm. You're in good hands. So, you know, it was a very formal set. I mean, working on a Hitchcock picture was a pretty, you know, could be a pretty daunting experience.
Did that mean you wore a tie if you were a man, for example?
Yeah, yeah. Out of respect. Yeah, out of respect. Wow. And oftentimes a jacket.
You know, it's interesting because you write about the fact that I want to, of course, talk about the shower scene, but there's a scene that I want to talk about also that you write about. And it's that, because I think this was such a crucial moment in some ways. It's that scene where Marion and Sam have that tryst, you know, that lunch hour tryst at the motel.
Right.
And you talk about that for Hitchcock, this was one of those scenes that was really, as you put it in the book, was going to announce that Psycho was a 60s picture, that Sam was going to have his shirt off, that Marion's going to be in a bra. I mean, this was really controversial. And I guess it sounds like it caused a stir even on the set.
A big stir, because this wasn't a European movie. this was a movie shot in puritanical America.
Yeah.
And more specifically in Hollywood that was still under the production code, where you needed to toe the mark in you know, certain aspects of what your film looked like, what it said, what it implied, what was, you know, physically shown. And if your movie didn't check off or tick off those boxes, there was a good chance the film would be cut severely, or perhaps not even get into theaters, and that would be a very expensive and embarrassing proposition. So this was a real make-or-break scene for him. And, you know, Hitchcock and his screenwriter, this is not a scene that really appears in the novel Psycho, but it's really an invention of Joseph Stefano and Hitchcock. And it's a, you know, look, it's a woman on a really long lunch break shacking up with her lover who has flown down from from a distance, an hour and a half away. And it's a big deal. Hitchcock talked about, you know, that the room would smell of sex and that it wouldn't be a nice hotel because Sam couldn't afford it and neither could Marion. And it'd be in the middle of the afternoon. And it was all kind of furtive and quiet and hidden away from the world. And, it was a big deal shooting because, a star of Janet Leigh's stature, let alone of any actresses, American actresses' stature, didn't appear on movie sets half-dressed. It wasn't done.
Yeah.
And, Hitchcock later lamented, but he lamented at the time that he wanted to get a shot where it was clear that Janet Leigh didn't have on her bra, and that while they wouldn't show anything, it would be clear that her breasts were rubbing against his chest. And he felt that audiences had really changed and that the people that would be seeing this movie were younger, hipper, cooler, and could be doing the very same thing that these characters were. So it was about audience identification, but it was also about, this is not your dad's Hitchcock picture.
Yeah. You know, one thing comes through really clearly in your book, this idea that for Alfred Hitchcock, he really thought about ideas or concepts in visual terms. And it brings us to the shower scene. And you've sort of talked about the fact that there were a lot of censorship considerations that he had to keep in mind. I mean, in these days, this was 1959, so you couldn't show nudity. You weren't supposed to show blood, at least not in that way. You weren't supposed to show a weapon, you know, penetrating a body. And the way he crafts that scene, that shower scene, he essentially does all of those things, but doesn't do some of them. Mm-hmm. Talk about the way he created that scene, if you would.
Well, it's impossible to overstate how dramatic and how impactful and how daring that scene was, and how difficult it was, in that it violated virtually every taboo, as you just mentioned. And so Hitchcock was looking for visual ways to telegraph all of that without telegraphing anything.
Yeah.
And he brought in a great, great graphic artist and visionary, Saul Bass, with whom he had done Vertigo.
Yeah.
And Mr. Bass at the time was very famous for doing, you know, extraordinary title sequences. But Saul Bass, like many great artists, was far more than that. And they were looking for a way to show very little and imply a great deal.
Yeah.
So they came up with this idea of rapid cuts where a woman would step into the shower and it would be cut, cut, cut. It would be normal. It would almost be like it could possibly be a TV commercial of a woman in a shower. And suddenly all hell breaks loose. Violence erupts. Mm-hmm. And how do you show that? What does it sound like? What does it feel like? And so Mr. Bass came up with Mr. Hitchcock with this idea of quick cuts to imply extreme violence and especially extreme violence in a very enclosed, very vulnerable setting. That is, a woman naked in a shower stall, where how do you get out when someone is blocking blocking your exit with a butcher knife.
Yeah.
And so the whole idea was to let's do cut, 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 just so that the audience becomes basically a participant in this. The audience will fill in the blanks. The audience will see what we're not going to show. The audience will hear and imagine what we're not going to put on the track. And so they did a rough assemblage of footage with what Hitchcock called the nudist, a young model, because they wanted to see first of all what it would look like if they cut this together, and then they actually had to shoot the sequence, and Janet Leigh was brought in on all the aspects of what they were going to do, and she was reassured that of course they were not going to show her breasts nor any other part of her body, but they were going to make certain that the audiences left that theater quite sure that they had seen a naked woman being stabbed in the most horrifying way and with tons of blood, none of which happened, by the way.
Right.
And yet the impression is transferred to the mind of the audiences, which is a trick that Hitchcock had been doing, you know, right from the beginning,
right.
You know, do it with shadow, do it with sound.
Why do you figure, I guess the question is, what's it like for someone with a more modern sensibility, even someone from a younger generation, didn't grow up in the 50s or even the 60s. What do you think it's like for a person of a younger generation to experience Psycho now? And does it still work in the same way, do you think?
I think it'd be impossible for it to work in the same way because, we've all seen too much.
Yeah.
I mean, the society has changed, what we can see on television, how violence is, you know, part of the fabric of everyday society, and it's part of the dialogue every day. How almost unimaginable violence has come out of the nightmares that Hitchcock was presenting into our dayscape. And it's how I know is that kids come up to me all the time at screenings of the film or at book signings and in other places, and some of them are they remind me of myself as a kid. Mm. They're just over the moon about the power of cinema and about the emotional power that a film can have, And so it is reaching a certain population. But you know, but for the for the casual slasher film fan of a certain age, the Final Destination, the Texas Chainsaw Massacre 3D, that sort of cohort, where they don't really seem to care about character, or they don't really care about plot development. They what they seem to care about is a bloodbath. That didn't interest Hitchcock, and so Psycho really doesn't engage them because it just doesn't, doesn't have that, that kind of pop and that kind of, continual gratification that, that audience craves. What is eternal is Anthony Perkins as Norman Bates.
Yeah.
That character seems to get under the skin of everyone, of any age. And so he still haunts people's dreams and young people's dreams, because I hear that all the time.
Stephen Rebello. He's a contributing editor to Playboy, the author of Alfred Hitchcock and the Making of Psycho. The movie Hitchcock is based on the book. It's running through Thursday at the Broadway Cinemas in downtown Salt Lake City. And he joined us from a studio in Los Angeles. Stephen Rebello, thank you.
Good to be with you.
Radio West is a production of KUER News. Our thanks to Taylor Almond. The show directed today by Michael Havey. The program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.